The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning. Happy to be here again with this group. And today I thought we would explore the wisdom that can be offered through a story, through a description of the Dharma that comes in a kind of a narrative form that touches us in a different way than something logical or something that we might think about. And there are, as always, many ways to engage with a story, to find ourselves in it or relate to it or imagine some connection to it. So what I'm going to offer is definitely not something definitive, but more a possibility for how we might read a particular story, and I've chosen one from this book, A Monastery Within, which is written by Gill. And I hope we'll have some time also to hear, you know, what you hear in this story. So let's kind of dive in and see what's being explored here, what aspects of the Dharma are brought out through this medium. So this story is called Inside Out, and it starts like this. An engineer had been a regular and devoted visitor to the monastery for many years. The meditation practice taught at the monastery was the only thing that made sense to him. In fact, the pragmatic logic of the meditation teachings gave him hope that he could overcome his chronic unhappiness and deeply felt pain. He tried all the meditation practices that the abbess taught him. He began each practice technique with enthusiasm, only to have each one end with the same frustration. He would encounter a wall he couldn't pass. The closer he came to the wall, the more he would recoil back into trying to think his way out of his pain. So, you know, we may not be a literal engineer. That may not be our training and our profession. But I think we could say this refers generally to the part of us that wants to figure it out, that believes our thoughts and thinks that there needs to be some kind of understanding of things in a logical way in order to feel like we've succeeded or gotten it or done the right thing in practice somehow. So this engineer is enthusiastic and willing to try. It's not that he has some kind of hindrance about even arriving at the teachings. He comes to the monastery regularly, loves all the practices. But, so then we know then that his barrier is somehow internal, the fact that he keeps hitting this wall. And we're told where it is implied that the challenge he has is that the closer he comes to the wall, the more he recoils back because he's trying to think his way out of his pain. So this is just the setup. And I think we maybe can hear some of this in ourselves. And notice also that he focuses very much on his pain and his unhappiness. You know, this is why he's doing the practices. And I think this is true for a lot of us also, is that we come to practice out of some kind of suffering that we're feeling in our lives, some kind of sense that I don't know what to do and there's got to be another way. But he's kind of running at it and trying to break through this wall by thinking about it. And he runs into it again and again. So, offering him much support, the abbess encouraged him to relax, trust the practice, and simply feel his inner pain without reacting to it. After many years, the abbess decided a different approach was needed. During his next visit to the monastery, the abbess told him that if he wanted to continue being her student and to be able to return to the monastery, he would have to take on a special practice. Once he had completed the assignment, he could then return for deeper teachings. Once more feeling hope, the engineer quickly agreed. The abbess said, "For 2 years, I want you to volunteer 10 hours a week at the maternity ward at the local hospital. The hospital needs people to hold babies who are born prematurely. If they don't receive enough physical contact, the babies will not grow healthily. When you have finished these 2 years, please come back to see me." So that's pretty interesting, huh? So the abbess first asks him to trust feeling his pain. She says, you know, you're hitting this wall, you got this pain, can you just feel it? And he can't do it. You know, he realizes this is not, and for years, you know, for many years. So she realizes, okay, this is a serious thing. So we can ask ourselves, what pain are we not willing to trust? You know, what is it that we run into in our practice where we're not quite ready to go there? And it's fine, you know, everybody, many people have this. But we can be aware for ourselves if maybe there's some kind of pain that we're not willing to trust and just feel it. Can we just feel it? So the abbess has some wisdom in realizing that some other approach is needed. She's not stuck on the meditation that she's teaching. She doesn't say, well, I'm sorry, these are the practices that we teach here, and if you can't handle them, then this probably just isn't the place for you. You know, she realizes, okay, different people need different things, and the monastery is not the place for this man at this time. So her compassion is broad and not limited to her own, the Dharma talks and what, you know, the practices that she's offering there. And notice also that this is a significant assignment. I mean, it's 2 years that he can't come. She's pretty tough, too. This is the condition for continuing to be her student and continuing to come to the monastery. Teachers aren't always so blunt these days. Maybe they're too afraid people wouldn't come back. I don't know. But this was her idea for him. I actually know somebody who... I mean, I just said teachers aren't always so blunt, but I do know a monastic person who was told by their monastic teacher quite strongly that if they wanted to continue being a student with them, with this teacher, then they would have to do a certain thing. So I guess it does still happen. But this was a monastic situation, not a lay teacher. When I read this, I felt like the man was actually kind of lucky to get a special assignment. She was putting some real effort into his practice, really supporting him. Maybe next time the teacher tells us something, we can say, wow, I'm special. Not that we're aiming to be special, but by any means. But just the sense that, you know, maybe this strange thing they're telling me to do is something really good. Okay. So the man was quite perplexed by this instruction, but because of his trust in the abbess and his failure to find any relief elsewhere, he plunged into volunteering in the maternity ward. He was surprised at how small and fragile the babies were that he held. He would hold them ever so carefully. He would watch their every breath because they all seemed in danger of stopping breathing. He spent a lot of time thinking about how he could more effectively care for the babies he held, but there was nothing more effective than simply holding them against his chest. So notice his trust in the abbess. Remember that his problem originally was that he couldn't trust his own feelings and just be with them during meditation, but it happens that he does have trust in the abbess. And so this is also something we can reflect on for ourselves. You know, what is it that we trust in the practice There are often areas where we have more or less trust. Maybe we trust what we read in the suttas, but we don't trust what somebody tells us. Or we trust our own inner feeling, but we don't trust what somebody else conveys to us about their inner feeling. You know, there are various combinations of things that we're willing to take risks for, and it's helpful to know which areas those are and which areas those aren't in order to know when we get stuck where we can go to, you know, where are we going to have the trust to take the next step. Let's try to find something in that area that's going to work for me instead of just grinding my wheels in this particular place. So he trusted the abbess, even though he didn't trust his own meditation. Maybe that's why she gave him an assignment that wasn't meditation. Also, the first thing that this paragraph said is the man was quite perplexed by this instruction. So he's perplexed. He's trying to think about it. And it's, as often happens, the logical mind doesn't really understand the realm of the heart. So the heart speaks in a different language, and it affects the mind-body system in a different way than our logical thought does. And so if we try to filter things through, does this make sense, does this not make sense, am I perplexed, do I understand, a lot of things that are happening internally for us aren't going to make sense, and they don't go through that filter very well. And that was exactly the barrier that this man has, or that most of us have in some way. And so we can notice for ourselves, for example, how we feel about devotional practices. What do we think about bowing or chanting or some of the heart meditations that are offered, metta practice, for example. These things that are not so logical necessarily. And sometimes, especially in this society, we'll have perplexity about them if we're feeling open, or hostility towards them or something if we're a little more closed. It may be a little bit extreme that this man had no concept that holding babies would be a useful practice at all, but variations on this theme appear all the time. I think it's interesting, actually, that when I was reading this story, I remembered that I had gotten an instruction like this from Gil fairly early in my practice. He suggested that I volunteer in a hospital, and I did. I volunteered at Lucille Packard Children's Hospital. I wasn't holding babies, but it was a very fruitful practice for me. I wasn't barred from being his student or from coming to IMC if I didn't do it. But it was his suggestion at some point. And I did find it useful. I've gone on, actually, to do other things related to that. I later became a hospice volunteer, and I'm currently serving as a volunteer chaplain in a hospital now. And some of the, you know, some of the fruits of this have not completely unfolded, but I can say that there has been certainly a reduction of fear. You know, being able to walk into a situation where I don't know the people but try to be helpful in some way. Reduction in fear of things that can be hard for people to look at, like death, like serious illness or disability. Being in a situation where one has to approach that and offer something can really be a maturing practice. It also connects us to compassion. Seeing that this is, you know, there's what really separates us from the person in that bed is not much. It's not much. Maybe a difference in age or just a difference in circumstances in them having an illness and me not having that illness today, at least. So in the same way, this man is discovering some of those things. He holds these babies, and his mind expands a little bit outside of his own world to another being. Oh, I'm now charged with caring for this baby. And so then habitually, you notice, he thinks about it. It says he thought a lot about how he could care for them more effectively. You can just see him sitting down and thinking about it, taking little notes. And in the end, what matters, though, is just he didn't find anything better than just holding them. Noticing the baby's breathing, feeling a connection to another human. Really, it's pretty simple in the end, but his habit of thinking through, he had to go through the process still of thinking about it. So slowly he's learning just to be with things. He's learning that he doesn't need to think about it and that it's okay just to do something very simple, like holding these babies, holding something tenderly in his attention. So notice that this is exactly what he couldn't do in meditation, is that he couldn't be with those feelings. And so now his instruction is to go do it in an external way, and maybe through some side entrance. He's gaining some skill in what he couldn't do in sitting meditation. Okay. After about 6 months, he started feeling something quite new. He started feeling a little spot of warmth and softness in the very center of his being. Since this was a foreign experience that didn't fit any of the ways he thought about himself, he ignored it. Ignoring it was the best thing he could have done, because it prevented him from interfering with the warmth by thinking about it too much. Over the following months, this tender spot grew until it pervaded his body. As it did, the cold, dark wall around his heart slowly relaxed, thawed, and dissolved. So this is interesting, is that one thing I noticed about this is that even without consciously doing some kind of loving kindness or compassion practice or consciously working with the fact that he thinks too much or something, his heart is softening. It's interesting that the processes that we go through in our practice work even without the notion of developing ourselves, right? So it is true that we spend a lot of time, at least in this culture, thinking about our self-development. We come to practice because we think we need to be a more compassionate person, or we need to let go of our anger, or we need to overcome our social anxiety in some way. We have these ideas of, I need to work on this, I need to figure this out, or I need to confront this in some way and move into a new realm in my life. And these are actually wonderful intentions. I'm not downplaying that, but I'm pointing out that it is possible in practice to overcome these things, go through these transformations without the conscious notion that that is what we're doing, without consciously working on certain things. Maybe more subtly, we could say that this practice undermines a little bit the concept of agency in our self-development. Is it really we who are developing ourselves? Or is there some process that happens? Maybe it happens when we get out of the way. I notice also that the story says that the man can't understand what this warmth is that's happening. It doesn't fit any images of himself that he has, so he ignores it. And this is so true, isn't it? We're mainly trapped by a limited self-image of ourselves in many ways, and we see this more and more as we go through practice. I've certainly seen this for myself, is that I had ideas of this is how I am, this is what I can be, and those have quite often turned out not to be true. And there were even parts of myself that I couldn't see. I had no idea that I was capable of, until it was suggested to me, that I was capable of going and volunteering in the children's hospital. It just hadn't occurred to me. But as soon as that suggestion was there and I kind of went with it, it turned out to be very interesting and useful. And all that was needed was somehow a pointing out that limitation, that wall, was somehow in my mind, and I hadn't seen it. One function of a teacher can be to point out new things that are emerging that we're not able to see. And the teacher might point us towards them or give us a little suggestion. But again, it's not necessarily necessary that we have that really conscious view of what we're doing. I think it's a nice little surprising twist in this story that ignoring this spot was exactly the right thing to do. There's a little surprise when you hear that sentence, at least for me. Because, you know, we feel like, oh, this is an awareness practice. We're supposed to know everything, analyze everything. And actually, that can take it into the realm of thinking, into the realm of thinking that we know who we are, thinking that we know everything about ourselves and that we understand what's happening and what's unfolding. And sometimes we can freeze or stunt things in that way by focusing on them too much, bringing our attention to bear and fixing them into an idea of what's happening. Our good qualities really do grow on their own. We're told that simply by having them there and by not getting in their way, they will continue to be nourished in some way and continue to grow. Noticing them in the right way can be helpful. Noticing them with mindfulness, with appreciation, with a kind attention that allows them simply to be what they are, that is very useful. But noticing things with an analytical eye of this is what this is and this is what it means, that actually cannot be, maybe is not so helpful in every instance. I can say this happened for me, actually, in the area of a kind of social fear or, you know, it wasn't extreme, but there, you know, I have noticed often that going into new situations or being in uncomfortable situations, I would find myself with some habitual tension or not sure what to say, these kinds of feelings that are a little unpleasant and hard to be with. And over time, through the course, you know, I was aware of that about myself, but through the course of practice, I found that that has steadily diminished and become less of a challenge for me in terms of just everyday living, daily life practice. But that didn't happen through going to anxiety workshops, doing improvisational comedy to get over those kinds of things. Maybe I should, that'd be kind of fun, I think. But it wasn't necessarily something that I attacked directly. I didn't walk in and say, I've got to work on this. So I feel like, nonetheless, over time, whole areas of suffering can just drop away just through the practice of mindfulness and through working in daily life and through bringing openness and kind-heartedness to all of our activities, kind of following the Eightfold Path. Okay. When he had completed his 2 years of volunteering in the maternity ward, the engineer returned to the monastery. The abbess saw immediately that he was a changed man. He was no longer desperate, and he was no longer trying to fit everything he experienced into a conceptual framework. Now he wanted to learn what else the abbess had to teach. So interesting, right? He was no longer so desperate. He wasn't just leaping into everything to try to solve this pain he had. And for sure, this thing about the conceptual framework, that's something that we all do in so many ways. You know, we have our ideas and our views about what practice should be, what Buddhism is, what sitting means, what's supposed to happen, etc. So these conceptual frameworks are useful to some degree. We're not going to have our life without, you know, be able to live our life without some kind of views, living by some understanding of what's happening. And yet the trick, the subtle trick that we're working on is to not be limited by those views, to not cling to them in some way and try to fit things into them as opposed to letting things be as they are. I see this in the hospital where I volunteer now, is that in one room, the patient praises the staff and says, they're so helpful, I love the way everyone here is really caring, and I just feel so appreciative of that. And in the next room, they say, the people here are so challenging. You know, the staff, I don't think they're very supportive of me, and I can't understand what they're trying to offer. Is it a different staff? Well, no, but it's a different set of conditions that's happening between the staff and the patient. The patient's bringing different things internally from their own psychology. There's something happening in the interaction. The staff has their own way of being. So we see that actually the view of a situation, you know, whether we say something is working really well or not working, how it feels, we can begin to see that this comes about as a result of various causes and conditions, and it's not something inherent or absolute that has to be a certain way. So this story is called Inside Out, as a reminder, and our conceptual frameworks largely come from without, actually. They're things that we learned from society, from reading things, from our parents, from our culture, from our ethnic background, our karma, our physical disposition. All kinds of things have created concepts about who we are, how the world is, how things should be, and how they should relate. And this story is pointing more, I think, toward the internal process, what's inside, trusting that and allowing that to shape kind of how we relate, and to trust something a little bit more in our heart, a little bit more emotional, related to our deeper intentions. We can also see that, after the 2 years he came back, and the Abba saw immediately that he was changed. He hadn't been meditating for 2 years, but he'd been doing this other kind of practice. And this can happen for us also in our practice. If we hit a spot that it seems like the meditation is a challenge, we're not able to be with the feelings that are coming, or something, sometimes just doing something else can be really great, really the best thing for us. There are many ways to practice the Eightfold Path. It's meant to be a whole life practice, something that engages every dimension of our life and our being. So we might consider for ourselves if there's some other kind of practice that we could be doing right now, or that we could do to supplement our meditation practice, some kind of action in the world, or some kind of something at work, something at home that would support us in a more complete way. At the Insight Retreat Center that's associated with IMC, there was just a Dharma Integration Weekend a couple of weekends ago. And it was focused on the practice of work. And I think you know from Andrea leading this group is that Andrea very much has a lot of teaching around daily life practice and around how to bring awareness and mindfulness into all of our activities. And this was something that we were focusing on in particular for a whole weekend during this Dharma Integration Weekend. And it was, there were teachings about how to engage with activities, to notice our mind while we're doing things. And then there was even some talking. It wasn't a totally silent retreat. People shared their experience with how it was for them to do work in a mindful way, and they shared some reflections about their own history of work. How do they usually relate to work? What were they taught about how to do work? Do they have concerns about doing it right, about needing to do it completely, about perfectionism, about sloppiness? All kinds of things started coming out just through, and you know, what had we done? We'd gone out and washed the deck and wiped down some railings and done some weeding. And people were finding all aspects of the Dharma in these very simple activities, as well as housekeeping and cooking activities that were going on that weekend. So for some reason in the West, we have an idealization, I think, of meditation and sitting on the cushion as kind of the essence of practice. Whereas these other elements can really bring new dimensions to our practice and our understanding, and it can open new channels, kind of through side passages like the abbess realized that this other activity was going to help the engineer who was spending too much time thinking on the cushion. So I encourage you to consider other ways that mindfulness and different dimensions of the Eightfold Path, such as wise speech or wise intention, can enter your life from other activities, not only through the sitting. It can also be true that people can have genuine awakening experiences on the cushion that don't become integrated through the rest of their life unless they do other kinds of practice. So even if you have been sitting for a long time or have a practice of doing many long retreats, having these kinds of genuine awakenings or powerful experiences through that kind of practice, we can't necessarily assume that that then pervades our whole mind and is going to, that kind of wisdom is going to be with us in our work, in our family life, in other areas of our life. We may need to find something much simpler. Maybe it's time to go out and scrub the deck a little bit if we've had a good experience on the cushion, or some other way to bring the fullness of meditation into our life. It doesn't necessarily happen on its own, because the mind is a complex thing with a lot of nooks and crannies. And to really saturate ourselves with the practice, we may need to do different kinds of activities. So it says that the man was now ready to learn what else the abbess had to teach. Giving him a new instruction, the abbess said to him, "When you meditate, don't think about what is happening. Rather, let your awareness be seated in the tender warmth you feel in your body. If you do this, any meditation practice you do will be fruitful." The man found this to be true. So, somehow, through holding babies, this man gained the ability not to think or not to be caught in his thinking quite so much. And that the implication is that this is the key to having an ever fruitful practice, you know, to having focusing on this warmth in his heart that is somehow non-conceptual. You know, it's just something that pervades his body at a very basic, fundamental way. Is something that that can provide nourishment from the inside. I'm expounding a little bit, it doesn't exactly say that, but this is my interpretation, is that at some point it's important in practice to let go into something that's deeper within us. We're not only trying to escape from suffering by thinking our way out, developing ourselves, figuring out what's wrong and solving it, but instead there's something else that begins to soften us from the inside that, instead of figuring everything out, we let go of the need to figure things out. And that's a different kind of freedom than the freedom of totally understanding everything step by step. He's not so desperate. He's not just trying to relieve the pain. He's willing to just sit with that warmth and see where that's going to take him. So may your practice turn you inside out and help you connect with that deep warmth inside of your heart, however that happens, whether it's you find it on the cushion or scrubbing the deck or holding the babies. I think for everyone, there's some way to find that insideness that is actually what we're seeking. So there's a lot in this story, actually, and in a way I'm a little bit sorry to have gone through it in so much detail and offered so much of, my own sense of what it's pointing toward. So I'm happy that we have a little time left. I would love to hear from some of you what you heard in this and how it touched you, because that's the real value of a non-thinking teaching like this, something that's going to hopefully touch us in a different way. Does anyone have comments they'd like to share? Yeah, could you use the microphone? when you speak, in, just press the button so it turns green, and then speak. Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
So I was just thinking, Gil chose closer, right? Gil chose a quite cerebral profession, a typically analytical, numeral kind of guy. But I wonder if the same things would apply if he'd, say, chosen a painter or a martial arts person. And I'm kind of posing that question because I do both of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times when the sense of mental activity becomes really important. How do I do this exactly, sort of thing?
Yes.
But equally, letting go of that kind of concentration can actually give you the answer or free up the practice to, and it works. Suddenly the brush stroke is just what you needed. Mm. And there's even a Japanese term, I think it's mushin, I think it means no mind, which is literally letting go, I suppose, just going with it.
Yes.
So, interesting.
So, yeah, you see that in these other professions. So maybe this speaks to the dimension of us that wants to figure things out or so forth. But that wonderful, what does it feel like, by the way, when you have that moment of letting go?
Well, it's totally freeing.
Oh, use the... It's okay.
It's really freeing.
Yeah.
And you just move.
Mm-hmm.
It's delightful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the beauty. Thank you. Yeah.
Do you know the book called Inner Game of Tennis, this kind of coaching classic? I think it kind of talks about this thing that we have, like this logical mind that is interfering us from doing things we can do naturally much better and useful. And I think for the artists, it's like it's a big hindrance, this logical mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it all has this kind of, I don't know, because I'm coaching artists, so I think it's very, we talk about engineers being like this kind of, I don't know if you understand what I mean. But the other thing that I heard about this story was like that we have these two mindsets, like this logical mind and then this some kind of other place. Soft warmness or something like that. And if the way we practice, whether it's sitting or anywhere else, it depends on who we think we are. If we think we are this logical mind, then we work from that place. And then if we think we are this softness, then we work from that place. Or then we... And I think why that kind of practice worked for this guy in this story, it was because he wasn't, if he had invented himself, like, I go to this hospital and then I will practice and then I will solve this problem, it wouldn't have worked.
That's
so
right.
That's what I see myself doing all the time, like figuring out what is the practice that will work. This is not working. Is there some other kind of practice that will work? There won't be any kind of practice that will work as long as I'm kind of trying to resolve. And it's very difficult kind of not playing that game from that place and just letting yourself go to that warm softness and kind of let things unfold. Naturally.
Beautiful.
So, yeah, it was a beautiful story. Thank you.
I'm not sure it's on. Is there a green light?
No, it's now it's green.
Yeah, okay, now.
Okay.
You're good.
This is more a just an addition to what the previous two said, and especially the last one. The story touches me because I've worked as an engineer, and I have the same block of being able to let go. I've only ever been able to do it in some realms, but one of the things with logic that came to mind as she spoke was that our logic is Aristotelian, Cartesian, but a lot of it's based on if A and B, then C. It's in the logic, and this is a new kind of realization for me, the logic is already kind of presupposing that we're focused on a goal, not just, you know, I mean, in and of itself, it's not. It's just saying, you know, if this is true and that's true, then, you know, then C is true or whatever, but the way it's frameworked in words, then, because then also has a connotation of in the future or some, you know, some result. And so in looking at things logically, you end up being focused on the result as opposed to focus on, you know, and you're just looking at inputs that aren't really processes. They're not, you know, it's not the doing. And when the brushstrokes that the painter has referred to, that's just the doing. And without the then, he waits until afterward. This is my impression because I've had the same experience doing some different types of artwork. He's not focused on the then. Sometimes you just do something and wait to see whether you like it or not. You know, and if you do, you'd stop. Or, you know, and if you don't, you add something. Or if you like it and you think there's more, et cetera.
Yeah, just letting it unfold in some way.
Not that I've figured out how to do that in most other aspects, but.
Thank you.
Thank you. In the first story, you used a term or a sentence, something to the effect, let things be as they are. And I'm just wondering, what is that? I mean, what determines the as they are?
That's a really good question. One thing that we... learn in practice as we do it is the degree to which we don't see things quite as they are, or we don't allow things to be quite as they are. And there can be an exploration as we practice mindfulness and practice sitting with our own experience of learning that what we see at the initial level changes as we observe it. So maybe let me give you an example, which is, suppose I'm sitting here and I feel pain in my knee because I've been sitting for a while on the floor. And at first, you know, I'm mindful and observant, so I say, pain. I feel pain in this knee. And then, you know, so I'm trying to be mindful of that. That's the practice, is to notice what's happening. But what is pain really? I mean, what does that mean exactly? Pain is a concept. It's something that we understand as a word that other people will know what I mean if I say it, generally. But when I really look at the pain in my knee more carefully, like at the physical level, I start to see that it consists actually of little sharp stabbing feelings mixed together with tingling feelings, mixed together with feelings of tightness. And sometimes these aren't very solid. Like I'll feel the tightness and the stabbing for a couple moments, and then there's a gap. And then I feel some tightness again. And it's actually a sort of an intermittent phenomenon. Whereas when I first looked at it, I thought it was solid feeling of pain in my knee. And so the series of sensations that I notice if I look more carefully is getting closer to things as they are. It's a little bit more fundamental. And then as we practice more, we can begin to see even kind of causes linking these. Actually, the phrase things as they are is sometimes translated as things as they have come to be. And it means how things cause each other. So I may notice, for example, that I have the little stabbing feelings in my knee, but if I, those stabbing feelings are partly coming from the fact that I don't like the fact that my knee is in pain. And so when I remove the thought that says, this shouldn't be happening, I'm angry about that, I don't want it to be here, I wish it would go away. If I don't have that kind of going on in the background of my mood, then I notice that there's actually quite a lot less intensity to the stabbing that's going on. So then we're starting to reveal more clearly, oh, there's a link between my mind and my body. So this is a kind of a long, detailed, maybe more than you intended with that question, I'm not sure, but that's starting to unwrap the layers of what it means to look at things as they are or things as they have come to be. And my understanding is that it just goes on and we learn more and more about our mind and body, and that helps us to free ourselves more and more from the suffering that we feel in our lives. Did that help, or is there more I could... Okay. Okay, it is 11:05, so we can... Thank you, everyone.